Good morning. The other day I came across a penny. It wasn't one of the new pennies, or P, it was one of the old kind, or D, which anyone more than, say, 15 years old will remember being legal tender. I expect we all kept a few at the time of the changeover, and now encounter them in that pot on the mantelpiece, at the back of a drawer, or holding curtains down. What enormous things they were, and so heavy. Having 11 pence in your pocket was a weighty undertaking, giving a sort of bias to that side of you, testing the very fabric of the pocket, and belt, and braces. I can remember a German once getting a handful of change, 17 and 10 pence or thereabouts, and wondering what to do with it as he cupped it in both hands and muttered English as gelt. The pockets of his lederhosen just weren't suited to that sort of ballast, and in despair he bought something else to get rid of it. Much more alarming then to every foreigner than the actual tonnage of coin which had to be carried around was its worth, whether 17 and 10 pence or £1.17 and 4 pence. Have any of you tried to do a sum recently involving that old-style currency? If not, let's try you out. What change do you get when you buy 5 yards at 6 and 11 the yard and you proffer a £5 note? Okay, if that's too difficult, just try subtracting 6 and 8 from 8 and 6. Still too difficult? Well then, just to give you some sort of confidence back again, what's 5 pence from 1 and 2 pence? Amazingly, to my mind, we used to do this sort of calculation without turning a hair or batting an eyelid. Even at school, we'd scarcely learnt the alphabet when we were multiplying £1.17 and 11 by 5 and then dividing the answer by 7. And you also remember that when the changeover came, the government put up posters everywhere to teach us the complex new rules. Instead of there being 12 pennies to a shilling, 6 to a 6 pence, 24 and a florin, 30 and half a crown, and 20 shillings or 10 florins or 8 half crowns or 240 pennies in each pound, there were going to be 100. Just that. For weeks and months they explained this new dilemma to us. 100 pence per pound, or 10 10-pence pieces. It was all very muddling. And when that great day came, 15th of February, 1971, we all dithered with the coinage as if we just landed in Timbuktu. "So this costs 50p," we said. "If I now give you a pound, how much change do I get?" The shopkeeper would do a sum, subtract 50 from 100, and tell us the answer was also 50p. Disbelievingly, we'd take the coin, mutter that it didn't look much like 10 bob, and feel we'd been diddled. I don't think we realised in those old days quite how confusing it all was to your average decimal foreigner. Whether it was 100 pfennigs to the mark, 100 cents to the dollar, or to the guilder, or to the franc, these other people were extremely used to 10 tens being 100. In Britain, they found that 10 tenpennies came to 8 and 4 pence, and their change for a £1 note was therefore 11 and 8 pence. So they could then buy another 10 tenpenny things. And this time their change was 3 and 4 pence. I can remember them looking perplexed, and I can also remember that it was their bewilderment rather than our system which I found strange. Of course, there was 2 pence and 3 pence, but 4 pence was never 4 pence as they seemed to think it ought to be. And it was equally solid information that 2 tanners made a bob, 5 bob made a dollar, and 17 and a kick left you 0.5 crown from the quid. So, no wonder we complained when decimalisation came along. Even if we did eventually master the confusion of 100 pennies in 1 pound, we had the feeling we'd been duped. Their way, not ours, had come to pass. So, too, with the gradual encroachment of the metric system. The solid facts of there being 12 inches to the foot, 3 feet to the yard, and a perfectly respectable number like 1,760 yards to the mile. Well, somewhere in authority, they decided this wasn't good enough. It had been good enough for generations of ancestors, but wasn't right for us. The metric system was decimal, and we had to have the metric system. But that switchover hasn't been the plain sailing it was planned to be. The packet may have 453 grams written on the outside today, but it's still a pound weight to most of us. We've forgotten, by and large, about tanners and bobs and 1 and 6, but we're still extremely loyal and conservative about the inch, the mile, the foot, the yard, the acre, degrees Fahrenheit, fathoms, pints, gallons, ounces, cubic feet, horsepower, and the rest of our inheritance. In fact, I'd go further and say that there's a silent conspiracy to resist the change as long as possible. In the same sort of way, we talk about 8p these days, resenting the novelty, instead of eightpence. All this thought came to a head the other day when I was driving along in Britain with a 100% genuine foreigner, one of those whose decimal and metric ways we're having to emulate. He was maddeningly good at English, as so many of them are, and steadily produced near-perfect sentences of the "I love your fields who are so green" kind. He was doing the driving, and I had plenty of time to agree with him that that field, who is over there, was indeed very beautiful. He was complimentary about the state of the roads, and also about our acceptance of the European road signs, the triangles, circles, diagonal stripes, and so on, that are meat and drink to the driving license examiners. "So sensible," said my friend, "that all of us the same language speak, at least on roads." I agreed that it did seem a good idea. Another sign then loomed, "Heavy plant crossing." My friend was amazed. "What is that on earth?" he said. "What is a heavy plant, and how can it cross? Are they down-cutting trees in this region?" By this time, we'd slowed to a snail's pace, with him looking this way and that, expecting some plant to cross the road. Even a light plant doing this would be fairly astonishing, but as for a heavy plant, and we slowed down even more. The British cars in the vicinity resented our speed, blew their horns irritatingly, and proved yet again that the horn is an offensive weapon, almost entirely used for reprimanding other drivers. Anyway, so far as the noise permitted, I explained that heavy plant was heavy machines, and as there didn't seem to be any of them about, we could resume our speed. "But why use words for which understanding is difficult?" he said. "Why indeed?" I replied, and suddenly realized that this must be the silent intent. Heavy machines or big machines would be understood by many more people than heavy plant, including British people, and the rest of the drive merely confirmed my dark suspicion of our wishing to confuse. For example, there was "caution adverse camber." "Caution what?" said my friend, as he slowed down yet again, causing an immediate noisy pile-up behind us. "Carry on," I said, explaining about camber and how such a thing could possibly be adverse, but then I had to explain what adverse was. I then had to explain about seeded verges and soft verges. "Do you know what a verge is in French?" he said, as he took a firm grip on the steering wheel and fell about laughing. "A verge is..." and here he petered out with his explanation. "Well, it's not something you want to be soft, at least not all the time." And here he drove across to the opposite side of the road as he tried to contain his mirth. By this time, I was getting the message and hoped that you have too. But what gobbledygook it all was, and why do we have to use such funny words when clarity ought to be intended? Even bona fide English people don't go around saying, "I saw this heavy plant hit the adverse camber and then the seeded verge." At least, if they do, then I move in different circles. "What is a dual carriageway?" asked my friend. "It sounds like the last century, or earlier even." I agreed that it sounded earlier even, and wondered what was wrong with dual road, or just double road. "Perhaps it means something more interesting in French," I suggested, and his mind sifted through the possibilities, but, alas, came up with nothing. Then there was ramp. "Oh, it's a bump," he said. And then there was a lay-by, of all things. "Oh, it's a parking," he said. And then there was a level crossing. "That's the most unlevel bit of road we've come across," he said, and once again we're on the right-hand side as he clutched at his body and the steering wheel, each alternately. I started making a list of all this strange language. Why do we come up with motorway, I wondered, when everyone else has an autostrada, an autoroute, an autobahn, and an autoput? And why elderly people crossing instead of old people? And why cul-de-sac, when even French people don't use that word, at least not for cul-de-sacs? Gully emptying was another one. "Just got to empty this gully," says one to another, "in case the ramp by the seeded verge prevents access to the elderly people's lay-by." "Yield," said a sign. "Yield," said my friend. "Give way," I said. "Ah, give way," he replied, as a piece of heavy plant or road haulage nearly had us into the open duct, gritted gully and soft verge lying adjacent to a ramp on that dual carriageway. We travelled west. "What's this place?" I asked. "It's called Criso y Cymru," he said, doing his best. "Welcome to Wales," I added. And then we hit all those road signs the nationalists have insisted upon. Heavy plant crossing still didn't mean much to my friend, but we almost touched a very heavy plant growing by the roadside these past 300 years, as he slowly read out, "Serbi dant gwaith in Croesi." "Now it's doubly incomprehensible," he said. "I don't think you've joined the car market. I don't think you've joined anything." He had a point, I must admit. But I learned later on that the Welsh don't mimic the English nonsense in their translations. For example, that heavy plant crossing becomes work vehicles crossing in Welsh, which makes a lot more sense. That's if you're not up the nearest plant trying to read the Welsh. Dual carriageway becomes fourth theffel in Welsh, or dual road. In other words, if you're already muddling most of the people by using a language most of the road users don't understand, there's no need to confuse the issue any further. Which all makes me wonder whether there isn't some basic plot among all of us not to be united into a common throng. In any organisation that I've ever come across, there's always internal slang, in-talk, a secret language that others on the outside are not expected to understand. At school, there were swinish geeks and unswinish geeks, and I've forgotten which it was better to be. In my family, there was a secret code which rendered my name as Anantat Hashananyash Sasmamitat Hash, and certainly nobody else outside understood that. In the Air Force, it was all kites, prangs, pancakes and angels, despite the perfectly good words existing beforehand for all these things. And in the rest of life, I found that jargon of a kind always exists, common talk on the inside, but foreign to outsiders. It's all part of the business, I suppose, of being in a clique, a private army, a village where we all sprang from, rather than the world in which we now find ourselves. We're all nationalists in our way, rather than internationalists, like the Welsh, who insist on G&B, rather than the universally known B&B, which you find everywhere else in Britain. Once upon a time, we led the world in a kind of linguistic insularity, as we went a couple of furlongs to the nearest boozer, handed over 1 8 pence for a pint and a half, complained about 1 1/2 inches of froth on the top, and pocketed 10 pence change from 0.5 crown. We can still confound the average skilled English speaker from overseas at the drop of a wink and a nod by scarpering to grab some shut-eye if the geezer in question could talk the hind legs off a moke, or is short with a ready when it's his round. But it's obvious that there's a hard core of experts of incomprehensibility to others somewhere in the transport business who are putting up all those signs. So, good luck to them, even if they do go a bit far and make the wordage a right load of cobblers to us Brits as well. Goodbye.